Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record Program number 693, Miscellaneous Articles and Updates. This program is being recorded on October 11th of 2009, and once again, please use the SpitfireList.com website. Now got all of my life's work, 30 years plus, up on the web, available for download for free. The only investment you have to make is one of time, so please use it. It is the best source for information about this kind available in DeVoiled, so please use it. What we're doing, as the title of this broadcast indicates, is updating various stories that I've investigated or that we have investigated together over the months and years. And when we left off, we were, well, I don't know about investigating, but we were talking about the financial meltdown. And in fact, we were visiting an op-ed slash rant from Matt Taibbi from Rolling Stone magazine from March 19th of this year. And it's called The Big Takeover, and he's talking about AIG and basically how that company went down. And let's just pick up with this particular rant by Matt Taibbi. Liddy, that's the head of AIG. Liddy made AIG sound like an orphan begging in a soup line, hungry and sick from being left out in someone else's financial weather. He conveniently forgot to mention that AIG had spent more than a decade systematically scheming to evade U.S. and international regulators, or that one of the causes of its pneumonia was making colossal, world-sinking $500 billion bets with money it didn't have in a toxic and completely unregulated derivatives market. Nor did anyone mention that when AIG finally got up from its seat at the Wall Street casino, broke and busted in the after-dawn light, it owed money all over town, and that a huge chunk of your taxpayer dollars in this particular bailout scam will be going to pay off the other high rollers at its table. Or that this was a casino unique among all casinos, one where middle-class taxpayers cover the bets of billionaires. And we're going to be taking a look at some of the people whose bets we have been covering. this is not going to be a particularly fun program. But first, you want some numbers? Let's talk about some numbers. The following is from Newsmax.com. It's from July 20th of 2009. Bailouts to hit $23.7 trillion, TARP chief says. It reads in part, "The federal government has devoted $4.7 trillion to help the financial sector through its crisis, a level of assistance equal to about one-third of the overall U.S. economy," a watchdog report said Monday. Under the worst of circumstances, the report said, the government's maximum exposure could total nearly $24 million or $80,000 for every American. The figures are part of a tough new quarterly report to Congress from Special Inspector General Neil Barofsky, who accuses the Treasury Department of repeatedly failing to adopt recommendations aimed at making one component of the government financial rescue effort more accountable and transparent. The $4.7 trillion commitment to the industry takes into account about 50 initiatives and programs set up since 2007 by both the Bush and Obama administrations, as well as by the Federal Reserve. Barofsky oversees one of the initiatives, the $700 billion Troubled Asset Relief Program. By the way, that was originally, the idea for that was originally put forward by the head of PIMCO, the bond trading subsidiary of Allianz, a major German insurer, and as one of the German core corporations, inevitably part of the Bormann Capital Network, about which I speak so often, and which is the focal point of the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. And really, that without coming to terms with that book, a lot of what I talk about on this program is just not likely to make a whole lot of sense. So please do take advantage of that. The book is available for download for free on the Spitfire website. Another piece of good news, not exactly a surprise, and not exactly good either. This from the Washington Post of August 28th of 2009, article by David Cho. It's headlined, "Banks Too Big to Fail," unquote, have grown even bigger. Subtitled, Behemoths Born of the Bailout Reduce Consumer Choice and Tempt Corporate Moral Hazard. Well, it's not new, is it? Reducing consumer choice and tempting corporate moral hazard. But it certainly does figure to be interesting. So let's listen to a little bit about it. When the credit crisis struck last year, federal regulators pumped tens of billions of dollars into the nation's leading financial institutions because the banks were so big that officials feared that their failure would ruin the entire financial system. Today, the biggest of those banks are even bigger. The crisis may be turning out very well for many of the behemoths that dominate U.S. finance. A series of federally arranged mergers safely landed troubled banks on the decks of more stable firms. And it allowed the survivors to emerge from the turmoil with strengthened market positions, giving them even greater control over consumer lending and more potential to profit. J.P. Morgan Chase, an amalgam of some of Wall Street's most storied institutions, now holds more than $1 of every $10 on deposit in this country. So does Bank of America, scarred by its acquisition of Merrill Lynch and partly government-owned as a result of the crisis, as does Wells Fargo, the biggest West Coast bank. Those three banks, plus government-rescued and owned Citigroup, now issue one of every two mortgages and about two of every three credit cards, federal data show. A year after the near collapse of the financial system last September, the federal response has redefined how Americans get mortgages, student loans, and other kinds of credit, and has made a national spectacle of executive pay. But no consequence of the crisis alarms top regulators more than having banks that were already too big to fail grow even larger and more interconnected. And looks like we may be paying still more to help bail these folks out. Following us in the L.A. Times of August 14th of 2009, article by Ralph Vartabedian headlined, Loophole in Government Program to Buy Toxic Securities Could Cost Taxpayers. This reads in part, a controversial $40 billion government program to buy toxic securities from ailing banks has a flaw that law enforcement and financial experts say could allow traders to illegally profit from inside information. Personally, I can't believe this. Can you believe that this $40 billion government program to buy toxic securities has a flaw that could allow traders to illegally profit from inside? I'm shocked. I can't believe such a thing would happen. Of course, I'm being sarcastic. Yeah, that doesn't surprise me one bit. Literally, it would be business as usual. Continuing, critics of the program say that without adequate safeguards, traders could use the tens of billions of dollars provided by the government to manipulate prices and exploit the swings in other trades. Because the government is providing 75% of the program's money, $30 billion, the manipulations could lead to significant losses by taxpayers. It's a conflict by design, said Neil Borofsky, the Special Inspector General for the Banking Rescue Program, who has urged tighter controls on the nine trading firms selected to participate. The Treasury Department, which is in charge of the program, says it intends to closely monitor trading activity to prevent illegal insider trading and profiteering at the expense of the public interest. But Borofsky said the government probably stands little chance of beating Wall Street at its own game. Quote, the Treasury cannot possibly match wits with the innovation and aggressiveness of Wall Street, he said. If you give them a set of rules and there are technicalities and legal loopholes and things we haven't thought of, they're going to find that out, not because they are bad, but because that is what they are supposed to do. They are supposed to seek out profits at all costs. Unquote. And, well, I guess we're going to be seeing just how far that goes. And we're going to be seeing just how that impinges on us. One of the problems with the bailouts and with what is taking place, obviously everybody, including yours truly, is scared witless at the prospect of a complete financial meltdown. I don't think anybody wants that. On the other hand, programs are being implemented, things are being put through that really are not, certainly not very well understood, if at all, by the public, and I'm not at all sure that an awful lot of lawmakers who are putting these things through really understand them very well either. They may understand very well the paychecks that are put in their campaign coffers or the checks that are put in their campaign coffers by large corporate interests that stand to profit from some of the things that they're doing. But I'm not sure that a lot of the lawmakers themselves fully grasp the technicalities here. Going to take an article about American International, because American International is anything but out of the woods, meaning basically that we are anything but out of the woods, because we are now the guarantors of that. And we're going to take a look in just a minute at how complex some of these things are. First of all, as far as AIG being out of the woods, not by a long shot. The following article is from the New York Times of July 31st of 2009. It's by Mary Williams Walsh. It's headlined, After Rescue, New Weaknesses Seen at AIG. And it reads in part, The dozens of insurance companies that make up the American International Group show signs of considerable weakness even after their corporate parent got the biggest bailout in history, a review of state regulatory filings shows. Over time, the weaknesses could mean trouble for AIG's policyholders, and they raise difficult questions for regulators who normally step in when an insurer gets into trouble. State commissioners are supposed to keep insurers from writing new policies if there is any doubt that they can cover their claims. But in AIG's plays case, regulators are eager for the insurers to keep writing new business because they see it as the best hope of paying back taxpayers. In the months since AIG received its $182 billion rescue from the Treasury and the Federal Reserve, state insurance regulators have said repeatedly that its core insurance operations were sound, that the financial disaster was caused primarily by a small unit that dealt in exotic derivatives. But state regulatory filings offer a different picture. They show that AIG's individual insurance companies have been doing an unusual volume of business with each other for many years, investing in each other's stock, borrowing from each other's investment portfolios, and guaranteeing each other's insurance policies, even when they have lacked the means to make good. Insurance examiners working for the states have occasionally flagged these activities to little effect. More ominously, many of AIG's insurance companies have reduced their own exposure by sending their risks to other companies, often under the same AIG umbrella. Well, we've taken a look at some of the machinations in which AIG has engaged in our visits with the remarkable Lucy Commissar. And by way of taking a look at some of the complexities involved here, we're going to tackle another article about AIG. And this is about some of the complex derivatives that European banks are going to be hanging on to. And I think this highlights some of the complexities. And I also want to stress that when dealing with articles like the one that I'm about to deal with, that we're about to deal with, I have to sort of plod through these a paragraph at a time. And so these are not subjects that I find easy to grasp either. In fact, far from it. I find it takes a lot of wrestling to come to terms with a lot of these articles. This is an article from Bloomberg News from July 17th of this year, and it's talking about some of the massive debt obligation that the AIG implosion this year created. And the article talks about European banks still having about $200 billion in derivative contracts with AIG that are insuring those European banks against losses in mortgage loans and corporate loans. And what is amazing here is that the average lifetime of the contracts for these corporate loans is 6 years, and for mortgages, the lifetime is 25 years. AIG's corporate loans are described in this article as being in the Netherlands an average of 45 years, with 30-year averages for France, Germany, and Denmark. The article claims that AIG has expected these banks to cancel those contracts, but representatives from the banks in the article, BNP Paribas and Banco Santander, say that it's nuts for them to cancel the contracts because the U.S. government, basically the taxpayer, you and I, are now backing these contracts up. So basically we're on the hook for these things. And, again, it's not easy to grasp this stuff, but, we're the ones who were basically stuck with grasping it. And, it's quite a hot potato. The article also points out that roughly half of the swaps are for corporate loans and the other half are for prime mortgage loans, presumably low-risk mortgages. And it's going to be interesting to find out just how prime some of these mortgages turn out to be in a failing global economy. And as the article points out, many of the major private financial institutions that would normally have had a large incentive to hold the European economy together aren't going to suffer many of these losses. And they basically could buy up a lot of each other's distressed assets at fire sale prices using some of the insurance money from AIG. Another thing that the article points out, and that, well, another thing that really looms large, I wouldn't say the article points it out, but that is whether or not the insurance policies are going to be denominated in dollars or in euros, because if they're denominated in euros, AIG's $200 billion in liabilities could grow substantially in the event of a continued decline of the dollar relative to the value of the euro. One way or another, things do not look good, and I would say that anybody who thinks that the AIG story is closed or that that file could be safely put away, I think better think again, because it looks to me like things are very much on hold, and that that is a situation which is going to very likely explode at some point in the future and bring down, do what it has not done yet, which is to completely collapse the global economy. In any event, this is the article from Bloomberg News from July 17th of 2009. American International Group Incorporated's trading partners may force the insurer to bear the risk of losses on corporate loans and mortgages for years beyond the company's expectations, complicating U.S. efforts to stabilize, the firm analysts said. European banks, including Societe Generale S.A. and BNP Paribas S.A., hold almost $200 billion in guarantees sold by New York-based AIG, allowing the lenders to reduce the capital required for loss reserves. The firms may keep the contracts to hedge against declining assets rather than canceling them, as AIG said it expects the banks to do, according to David Havens, managing director at investment bank Hexagon Securities, LLC. For counterparties to voluntarily terminate those contracts makes no sense, Haynes said in an interview. There's no question that asset values have soured on a global basis. With the faith and credit of the U.S. government backing those guarantees, why would they give that up? The falling value of holdings backed by the swaps may force AIG to post more collateral, pressuring the insurer's liquidity and credit ratings in a repeat of the cycle that caused the firm's near collapse in September, Citigroup Incorporated analyst Joshua Shanker said last week. The insurer needed a U.S. bailout valued at $182.5 billion after handing over collateral on a different book of swaps backing U.S. subprime mortgages. The average weighted length of the European swaps protecting residential loans is more than 25 years, while the span tied to corporate loans is about 6 years, AIG said in a regulatory filing. Contracts covering corporate loans in the Netherlands extend almost 45 years, and the swaps on mortgages in Denmark, France, and Germany mature in more than 30 years. The portfolio shrank by about half in 15 months to $192.6 billion on March 31st, and AIG's models show banks will abandon more contracts, said Mark Herr, a spokesman for the insurer. AIG said in a filing last month it expects the banks to cancel the, quote, vast majority, unquote, of the contracts in the next year as regulatory changes reduce the benefits of the derivatives for lenders. Quote, we think we're right because we're basing our analysis on actual behavior, unquote, said Herr. The inarguable fact is that half of the portfolio had been unwound at no cost to us as of March 31st, unquote. The contention that the swaps will last beyond a year is a theoretical argument that is debunked by bank actions, he said. Last month, AIG said in a regulatory filing that it may be at risk for losses for, quote, significantly longer than anticipated, unquote, if the banks don't terminate their swaps. Quote, given the size of the credit exposure, a decline in the fair value of this portfolio could have a material adverse effect on AIG's consolidated results, unquote, the company said in the June 29th filing. The Securities and Exchange Commission asked for AIG to add to the disclosure to the insurer's risk factors, unquote, Herr said. The action wasn't prompted by any change in the securities backed on the swaps, he said. Royal Bank of Scotland Group PLC, Banco Santander, Danske Bank, Rabobank Group NV, and Crédit Agricole S.A.'s Caillon are also among banks which purchased the swaps, AIG said in a presentation in February, pleading for its latest bailout. The banks could be forced to raise $10 billion in capital if AIG were allowed to fail, according to the document. Skipping down again, counterparties terminated or allowed to expire $27.8 billion in the so-called regulatory relief swaps in the first quarter, and AIG got notice for another $16.6 billion in terminations through April 30th, the firm said. Some of the remaining swaps have suffered losses, and AIG posted $1.2 billion in collateral as of the first quarter. Quote, you'll have an increasingly toxic pool of credit default swaps every quarter, unquote, as the least risky swaps are terminated, said Don Vickery, analyst at research firm Gradient Analytics, Incorporated. Swaps that are being held are done so for two reasons, either for regulatory relief or because they're, quote, in the money, unquote, which means they are valuable hedges against asset declines. AIG has recognized that some of the swaps are no longer being held for regulatory relief. The insurer reclassified $3 billion in swaps through March 31st that are likely to be kept after the regulatory benefit expires, AIG said. The firm had a $393 million liability on those swaps. Skipping down again, the $192.6 billion figure for the swaps includes $99.4 billion tied to corporate loans and $90.2 billion linked to prime residential mortgages, the insurer said. Quote, the sheer size of the portfolio and the black box nature of its underlying loans and assets do little to calm fears of further CDS losses, Shanker said in the July 8th research note. Again quoting, potential markdowns in the regulatory CDS portfolio may result in collateral calls that would again put pressure on AIG's liquidity. What Yogi Berra referred to as deja vu all over again, folks. I guess what can I say? Stay tuned, as I guess the best thing one could say. It's interesting that we've seen first Bernard Madoff and then Arthur Daedal, now R. Allen Stanford, allegedly being brought down for running Ponzi schemes. It seems basically that these are just the ones who got caught, and that basically an awful lot of the investment industry itself is really a large Ponzi scheme. It's, to a large extent, if you ask me, a criminal milieu. And to a past a point, it's rather like that Matt Taibbi rant, past a point, people have let themselves in for this one. Speaking of Alan Stanford, we haven't spoken about this alleged Ponzi scheme operator. The following is from the New York Times of August 29th of 2009. Stateline Houston, it's headlined, Blood Oath Sealed Stanford Deal, court is told. R. Alan Stanford's relationship with the chief regulator of his Antigua bank was closer than most. At a meeting in 2003, they became blood brothers, cutting their wrists and mixing their blood in a brotherhood ceremony, unquote, that Mr. Stanford's chief financial officer said promoted an elaborate scheme to hide a multi-billion dollar fraud from American and other regulators. The assertion that the two took a blood oath, unquote, was laid out in a plea agreement signed by the officer James M. Davis and filed Thursday. After the pact, Leroy King, Antigua's chief banking supervisor, called Mr. Stanford Big Brother, unquote. He received Super Bowl tickets valued at thousands of dollars for himself and his girlfriend. and he accepted regular bribe payments from a secret Swiss bank account that Mr. Davis said he was told to handle by Mr. Stanford. In the unusual twist to the case, in which Mr. Stanford is accused of operating a multi-billion dollar Ponzi scheme, was disclosed by Mr. Davis as he pleaded guilty on Thursday to fraud and conspiracy in federal district court in Houston. Mr. Davis, who oversaw the movement of vast sums of money at Stanford International Bank, also said in a plea agreement that Mr. Stanford ordered him to report false revenue and false investment portfolio balances to bank regulators as far back as 1988, when Mr. Stanford ran an offshore bank on the Caribbean island of Montserrat. So they had a, they became blood brothers. I wonder when the Madoff scandal went down, I wonder about Mr. Devier Shea. He was found dead of an alleged suicide. He supposedly took a bunch of sleeping pills and then tried to slash his wrists. And one of the cuts was on his bicep. I wonder if that was part of that, one of those blood brother secret oath type ceremonies. As I've noted, obviously I'm skeptical. The biceps are a long way from the wrist, and I've never committed suicide by taking sleeping pills and trying to cut open a blood vessel, but that's a long way, even with sleeping pills. That's quite a miss. Maybe that's what they were doing. One more about the personages who have cropped up in Mr. Stanford's retinue. This from the TPM Muckraker site from August 5th of 2009. It's by Zachary Roth. It's headlined, Rove's lawyer insists, I won't work for Stanford without getting paid. Looks like our old friend Alan Stanford is having some trouble finding a lawyer. Two high-profile white-collar crime attorneys, including the man who represents Karl Rove, are trying to make sure they don't get roped into defending the cricket-loving billionaire who's accused of orchestrating an $8 billion fraud without a guarantee of payment. The Houston Chronicle reported that last Friday, Dick DeGuerin, the heavy-hitting Houston defense attorney who has been working with Stanford for several months, asked the judge in the case to let him withdraw because Stanford couldn't assure him he'd be paid for future work. Stanford had earlier issued a press release saying he'd replace DeGuerin with Robert Luskin, Rove's lawyer on the U.S. attorney firings and other controversy. So that is who Mr. Stanford is trying to get to go along with him. And as we contemplate the wreckage that's all around us from the economic downturn, don't forget Roland Arnall, the guy at the center of the whole thing. Well, it's kind of hard to forget him because you don't know much about him to begin with. Remember, we don't know anything about him. This is all that we know about him from the book Chain of Blame. Only one thing seems certain about his early years, that he was born in 1939 in Europe. His family was Jewish, which meant their lives were in danger as Hitler came to power and Nazi Germany expanded its border by invading other nations. His official bio has him in Paris on the eve of World War II. An unconfirmed press report says that it was Poland. And the only other thing we know about him is that he contributes to the Wiesenthal Center. I've noted in For the Record 691, not only about Bormann Jews, but about an elaborate program to create false Jewish paper documentation for Nazis who were going to serve post-war underground work. One wonders about Mr. Arnall. Basically, we know nothing about the guy who was the Johnny Appleseed, so to speak, of subprime, and an individual whose actions helped to spin the web that is entangling all of us. His proclaiming that, my family was Jewish, and they fled the Nazi, and I contribute to the Wiesenthal Center, reminds me of Lee Harvey Oswald and his WDSU interview in New Orleans, where he's proclaiming his Marxist sympathies. As George Gershwin, whose birthday was recently, once wrote, it ain't necessarily so. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 693, Miscellaneous Articles and Updates. This program is being recorded on October 11th of 2009. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.